We will be having a talk on how to deal with bad moods. Our speaker is Maureen Chen. She's established social welfare organizations in Hong Kong and for victims of landmines in Cambodia. Maureen has been the coordinator and in leadership and meditation-based projects throughout Asia. She's currently based in the Yarra Valley Living Centre in Australia. So have I pronounced it correctly?
Yes,
I
yes,
have.
yes.
Good, excellent. We've asked Maureen to explore this topic with us. It's not just about the bad moods I may have and how I pull myself out or work through them, because it's not about suppressing or ignoring, nor is it about making my life harder than it already is. So how do we work through, and particularly if a mood sneaks up on us, not something that we were expecting, but also, is there a way of handling other people's bad moods in a way that leaves them feeling whole rather than them feeling shut down as individuals?
So, yes, I think where I'd like to start is at the time when I realized that when people would ask me, do you want to do this? Do you want to go there? Or I would ask other people, very often the reply was, I'll see how I feel. And when I noticed this about myself, I thought, do I want to be dictated to by my moods? Can't I say yes or no because I want to go? Why is it up to how I feel and that I have no control of those feelings, that I'll have a particular mood and feel to do something or not? So this started me thinking about this whole area. And I was working in government and in a role that was interfacing with the public. And very often I would meet people at the counter and I would be abused because of what's happened to them through the department. And I used to react and I'd say, what are you blaming me for? It's not my fault, you know, and take it personally. And a very nice saying that I read, it said, we can take everything with wisdom or woe. Wisdom or woe. And woe is when we take things personally. So that also really made me so aware. Why am I taking this personally? Because if any of my colleagues had come to the counter at that moment, they would have got it. So it's nothing to do with me. And it's kind of so egocentric to take this personally. I mean, I haven't got much to do with this in a way. So when I, you know, observed that, and at that time I started practicing meditation with the Brahma Kumaris. And I realized that if somebody was coughing, you know, that if they were coughing, I would do whatever I could to alleviate their discomfort. And when somebody's shouting, in a way, it's almost the same thing. When somebody's shouting, it's like an emotional cough. It's like, you know, coming out. So, what can I do to alleviate this person's anguish? So, I would just then respond to the person and say, okay, what do you want me to do? And the person wouldn't expect that. So, they'd keep shouting, and I'd repeat, okay, what do you want me to do? It would often take three attempts to get through to the person that I'm not going to fight. I want to help, and I'm genuinely asking, what can I do to help? That was amazing because so many people go into a government office, as many of you can relate to, with some issue and expect to have to fight. And in fact, it kind of made me wonder because when I did stop and talk to the person, they would often get tears because somebody's helping them, listening to them. And I thought, wow, what's going on? I get paid to help this person. And yet it's so unexpected. So that these things made me so aware of how my mood can affect another and how I need to protect myself from another person's mood. And within the practice of the Brahma Kumaris, I think you're aware that this whole aspect of the soul, that my original nature is a being of peace, and every other being has that as their true nature. So when I could see this person that was shouting at me as a being that is originally and naturally peaceful and who will thrive in peace, I just wanted to get back to connecting with who this person really is and not, you know, what we understand as the survival mechanisms of anger and manipulation or whatever. And anger is one aspect of manipulation. And so I just practiced, you know, what I was learning. And it was so great because often we'd go to the tea room, we'd say, oh, did you hear that person, blah, 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 and start to talk about the people who've been coming into our contact during the day. And instead it was like really free. I would go to the tea room and not carry that that impression of the negative experience. So this is where it started. And I then also, you know, really started to look at, as I said, my moods, why I can't be constant. And probably the most basic description of a yogi is to be in equanimity. That's really what you would describe as a yogi, as someone who can be equal in praise and defamation, heat and cold, victory and defeat. And I thought, that's a good goal. And I'm not like that, because I was really a very emotional person. And another saying that really helped me was from Helen Wambach. I don't know if you've read her book about life beyond death. And she said that wisdom is passion and tranquility. And I realize that I have a lot of emotion because I'm quite a passionate person. And I don't think I want to stop being like that, because I love people and I'm alive. So it's not a negative aspect in my life. However, I could do without all the emotion that goes with it. So wisdom is passion and tranquility. So tranquility to me comes from a philosophy of life that helps me to see the bigger picture. And I remember in Hong Kong, there was a wonderful woman who was very passionate about the environment. And I used to do special meditation for her because I loved her concern and her passion, but I felt that it was hard for people to really listen to her because, you know, when we're passionate, sometimes we can be angry and judgmental and blame. So I used to send good wishes to her, and we ended up working together for that wonderful project, Million Minutes of Peace, and then also for Global Cooperation for a Better World, and developed a wonderful relationship. But I could see for myself that I want to keep my passion alive, but I don't want to alienate people through that passion. So I need this balance of tranquility. And so I decided, I made a clear decision to reach that level of equanimity. And this particular saying helped me a lot. But what I started to observe, so then I started to observe, and I think that's the first step in dealing with emotions, which are behind our moods. So the first step was to observe the emotions. And what I saw is that I enjoyed excitement and euphoria and, you know, I'd like to connect. And so this passion came from an interest and a curiosity about life. However, if I had the highs, I also had the lows. And so I thought, well, I don't really want to give up the highs. I enjoy that euphoric kind of enthusiastic state. However, I don't enjoy the lows. And because my work was interviewing people, my work was to interview people all day. And sometimes I just wouldn't have the mood to do that. And pity the people that I met on that day, because I was just, you know, doing the job because I had to do it. So I decided that I'm going to work on this equanimity and see how it goes. I'm not sure I want to give up the highs, so let me experiment. I started with the experiment of this. And what I saw was that by choosing to be in equanimity, the happiness lasted longer. You know, I used to go through ups and downs, I don't know how often, but fairly regularly. But when I decided to have this equanimity, I saw that I was able to sustain a state of peace and happiness for longer and longer periods of time. So yes, I missed the highs and the emotions, but I didn't miss the lows and those emotions. So I decided this is how I want to move forward. It was a choice. And interestingly, at that time, there was one of our students who would come to the center very often, and she was an artist, and I would describe her as very beautiful soul. But she used to come to me when she was down, and so I was exploring this with her, and I could see that she was a very passionate person, and it was her choice. I told her, it's your choice to keep that passion and not to choose equanimity. So I'm not advising you not to have that passion. And maybe as an artist, you feel you need it for expression. But I said, I would appreciate if you don't come to me when you're down, because I think this is your choice for you to have the ups and downs is your choice. So you need to learn to manage the downs if you're deciding that this is how you're going to continue to live, because I've decided not to have the ups and downs. I'm willing to let go of those highs and that intense passion to reach a level of equanimity. And if you decide not to, I think you have to take responsibility. And so, you know, I would advise you to learn how to live with the lows. So I guess that's how I'm also managing with other people's moods and emotions. I don't buy into them. I will help them to, make a choice if they choose that, and to deal with the downs but give them the tools to deal with the downs. I'm not prepared to spend those hours every so often, because I think we all are responsible for our moods and emotions. Another thing that really helped me, and I think all of you probably know or have read Mike George's books, and he says in his books that he talks about the difference between emotions and feelings. And at first it just sounded like semantics, but he said something that emotions cloud feelings. Emotions are always a reaction and they're ego-based. So that really got me thinking about this whole area of emotions, because I noticed I still couldn't control emotions. But if I could get in touch with my feelings, I could work with feelings. I couldn't work with emotions. And so now I don't entertain emotions. I go deeper to get in touch with the feelings, and behind the feelings are a need. So that's what the work I do now, to manage emotions, feelings, to get in touch with the need. But that was a big insight for me and helped me to detach from those emotions. So I would say that my passion comes from a deeper place. It's not a reaction. It's a deeper place of understanding the issues, and also what they say, you know, dealing with things you can, where you can make a difference, and not with things that you can't. So that's also the wisdom that we need to have. Then there's also that whole area where, you know, they say that if I am me, because you are you, then I'm not me and you are not you. In other words, we are just a reaction to each other. If I am me, because you are you. So what it means is you can see how we can have completely different experiences with people. Like recently, I heard someone describe a person completely differently to how I would describe them. I thought, wow, that's so interesting. I never saw that aspect of their personality at all over years. So you can see how we're a reaction to each other. And in psychology, it's called becoming enmeshed, where we don't know where we end and the other one begins, and where they end and I begin. And there's a word that's commonly used in the teachings of the Brahma Kumaris, and it's detached. Often that's a very misunderstood word, because it actually comes from the Hindi word niyara. And niyara means to be unique, to stand apart from. So it's that kind of detachment. It's not caring, but it's the separation. And so when I can be more detached from you, actually I can be more loving, because whatever you are, you are. And I respond to that in my way, being who I am. And this aspect of seeing the love in detachment, as is said, that attachment is controlling. Detachment is allowing. So if I can allow you to be you, I can be more loving and more consistent, because, okay, you are you. So when, you know, I was talking before about relationships here, we also allow people to be who they are. We don't try to change people, but we do work on our relationships, because it's also said in the Brahma Kumaris that relationships, what are they for? Actually, what are relationships for? Relationships are for cooperation. So when I'm relating with another person, yes, I have my particular personality and set of what we call sanskars, personality traits. However, if I want to cooperate with you, I need to manage those so that I can bring about that cooperation. And so that's a very wonderful way to see relationship. And relationship, relating, is a verb. It's not a noun, just like love is a verb. It's not a noun. So I relate with you. Otherwise, we tend to take a relationship, very often we take it for granted once we have a relationship, like a son or a daughter or a parent or a spouse. And I remember, you know, at one point in my life, realizing how amazing my parents were. Before that, I'd taken them for granted, you know, that I could behave with them in a way that I wouldn't behave with others because they accepted me, they loved me. But then I thought, no, you know, they're worth more than that. They deserve more than that. They're amazing people. So I found that when I could see my mother and father as, you know, people in their own right, not just as my mother, as my father, the love that I had increased so much, because they also say love is recognition. So recognizing my mother, recognizing my father, gave me so much more respect, regard, and love. And so I was a different person around them. So dealing with moods and emotions, it's a lot to do with our recognition also of the other. And just as Covent Garden is a little shop, so if you went to the little shop at Covent Garden, you would expect to get some wonderful goods there, not only books and CDs and these kinds of things, but just as we are doing on Zoom, you expect to get something good that, well, you go to Covent Garden for peace, for happiness, for wisdom. And so it's almost like we are walking shops that I need to keep a stock of peace and love and happiness so that when I'm engaging with another person, I've got some stock there that they can take from, and we don't even charge. But there needs to be that stock. And when I saw myself as that, you know, effervescent kind of bubbly, enthusiastic person, I also noticed that I was a bit like soda water, that I would, you know, have this happiness, but it used to bubble away. And the next morning I would notice, I would wake up flat and I would think, what happened last night? I was so happy. And what I had done is bubbled it all away. And so to accumulate in that stock, I need to, you know, really be able to take that peace and that happiness within, almost like breathe it in and sit with it and not bubble it away. I still have a little bit of weakness in this area because of my enthusiasm. When I'm in a conversation, sometimes I interrupt another person, and it's usually about the topic. I'm engaging with them, but I get too enthusiastic and I interject. So that's a residue that I'm still working on, so that I can let someone else express themselves. You know, sometimes I get excited and jump in, and it's not bad, but it could be better. It could be better. So, you know, that's still a little residue of that, you know, enthusiasm. And I am an enthusiastic person still, but I need to, you know, relate to the other person and, you know, give space for them. Because actually one of the issues here is that two of the six of us living together are introverts, and the other four are extroverts. And so those two introverts hardly get a word in. So we have to consciously pause and give space, and in meetings draw out their ideas, because, you know, it's not, they take a lot longer to be able to express their ideas. And, you know, I mean, people who do take longer, often they have more thoughtful and broad points of view. So they are very valuable. And if we didn't give space for them to express, it would be our loss. And so relationship, keeping that stock. And yeah, going back to that point of just being more detached and the observer, also helps us to slow down, you know, like in this instance with people that are introvert, if we can observe, we can be aware of that and leave space for others to share. But that whole thing of slowing down in our communication. And I remember one time somebody came to me with a lot of anger and they said, oh, you are this and you are doing this and you are doing that. And I just started my nonviolent communication practice. And I really didn't know how to respond because I wanted to come back with a considered, calm response. So I said, okay, I need time to think about what you're saying. So I'll come back to you. And that just made the other person more angry because here they were, they probably built up this anger so that they could have the impetus to say what they wanted to say. And I just said, oh, okay, yeah, I heard you. I'll think about it. And the other person said, okay, Miss Cool as a Cucumber, and really got quite upset at me for being so calm. But still, I would say, even if the other person reacts to that cool as a cucumber state, sometimes we need that because actually they were making accusations about me that I hadn't really considered. And so I needed to take time to think, am I doing that? And, you know, I needed to reflect on what the person was saying. Now, somehow I'm able to manage that a bit better. I'm not as much as a cool as a cucumber. I'm able to say something like, oh, I really appreciate that you're expressing this. I can see that it's built up over some time and that you're pretty charged. And I'm sorry that I, you know, need a little bit of time to reflect and take in what you're saying. And I can't respond just now. So I'm able to dialogue a little bit better than I could before. Still, I think the other person's disappointed, but that's, you know, I think better than engaging in a conversation where I'm in denial or I'm not seeing or, you know, I'm taking on an attack. And so this is what I'm learning from the nonviolent communication. So that's very good to be able to observe, to feel, to check in with what I'm needing or what they are needing, because that's another aspect of dealing with other people's emotions. When somebody's angry, what I've learned to do is to listen for what they're needing, because it's a human nature to connect. It's deep in our DNA to connect. And so meeting other people's needs is connection. And think about it. I would say the majority of us really do want to meet the other person's needs, but it comes out often as an emotional reaction and we aren't able to see that this is a need. It's not an attack. It's an unfulfilled need that's crying out to be seen or heard. And so when I'm able to observe and feel and really get in touch with that person's need and what they might be feeling because of that need, then I'm able to communicate. And so this is also what I'm learning when somebody's shouting at me, to not run away, not to freeze, but to say, it sounds like you're needing. And if I get it wrong, they'll soon let you know. No, I'm not. I'm not needing that. I'm needing this. But once I've heard the need, I know where to go from here in that communication. And if I can listen to someone's need, I can then see what I might be able to do. And I can ask them, what do you want me to do? Just like that situation in the office. okay, what do you want me to do? What can I do? So, you know, really diffusing the situation by listening with empathy. And empathy really means being present. So when I can be present for the other person, then I can hear them. So just two more things briefly to mention, and that is food. There's a saying, as the food, so the mood. So if I'm able to be aware of how food affects my mood, because sometimes, like I think you might know that super wonder food called noni. At one point, I got some noni capsules, and I'm sure it's very good for health and it wouldn't affect everyone. But what I noticed is when I was taking this, it's a health supplement. I noticed that my mood was affected, that I was a little edgy, a little irritated. And I thought, is it because I couldn't see any other reason for this edginess. And I thought, oh, perhaps it's this supplement. And it could have been something else in the supplement. But I stopped taking that supplement because I felt that it was affecting my mood. And that's why, you know, as a meditator, we don't eat garlic and onion, because it's known to affect our moods. And interestingly, it's not just the Brahma Kumaris, but the Jains, the Buddhists, people who meditate generally avoid garlic and onion and the allium family. And I remember one lady, she was a mother, and she said, I don't know why I still get angry with the children. And I said, are you still eating onion and garlic? And she said, yeah. I said, try not having garlic and onion and see if it helps. And she did have that experience of it helping her to manage her emotions. So experiment, observe, slow down, experiment and see what is affecting the mood. And the last thing is music, because a lot of people use music for meditation, and they use a relaxing music, like an electronic kind of music. For me, that doesn't help my meditation at all. It helps me to relax, but doesn't help me to be still. Relaxation and silence are very different. Relaxation, I can be calm, but silence, I can be deep and still. So observe how music affects your mood. Of course, you can use music to be happy. You can use music to be sad, to be, you know, to just heighten the feelings. You know, music has a lot to do with our mood as well. So just be aware of any input. What am I taking in, and how is that affecting my mood? So I think we've covered quite a bit of ground there, and perhaps you have some questions or comments.
Before we go to the questions, could we have the meditation?
Yes, that's a good point to pause. So let's just reflect now for a few minutes on what's being shared. So the first step, even now we can see our mood change as we become more silent and go within. The easiest way to do that is just to observe the breath. And start to feel that detachment from everything outside. But now let's go deeper into that silent stillness. deep within myself is everything I need. Peace, love, inner power, and joy. Meditation is a training so that I can go within quickly, easily, naturally. And deeply. And I discover that beneath all the emotions there is the I that never changes. That pure, peaceful, radiant being. So when there are emotions raging all around, mine or others, let me drop down beneath the surface and touch base with my pure essence. So this is what I need to do to find the calm in the storm. But if I'm not able to do it through my own process, I can use music. I can go and find a place where the atmosphere will support me. But know that that place is there. I just need to access it. Om Shanti.
Thank you, Maureen. That was beautiful. Questions are coming in, so let's start with the first one. What tips do you give when someone is really down, even though they're taking responsibility, but their circumstances are difficult? They may not have a job or their health is bad. At that point, what do you do?
Yeah, and it, of course, this is a very big question right at this moment, because a lot of people are struggling even more than they were before. So I think what's very important is empathy, means to listen, because often when people can hear themselves and somebody listens to them, a lot is released just in that listening. And so we can make a proper time. What I mean by listening is not just, you know, superficially listening, because that doesn't always help. Often, you know, people are talking to me and I've got something else that I need to be doing. But if I make a time and really listen to the person, with full presence. And what I also suggest is to, you know, I practice this with my nonviolent communication. I have some empathy buddies. So I have someone that I will talk with, but we make a time, like, you know, next Wednesday night from 7 to 7:40, I will speak for 20 minutes. They will speak for 20 minutes. And I find this very good because if I have something heavy in my heart and I've made an appointment with someone and I express, you know, what's going on for me, but I have a time limit, you know, so that sometimes when we're trying to help people, we get fatigued by, you know, listening to the same thing over and over again. But when we give proper, full, undivided attention for 20 minutes, so much can come out. But then the practice is that they would also listen to me for 20 minutes. And what I've found good about this process is that sometimes the other person only has good news, and I listen to their good news and I feel happy for them. So it brings me out because I'm connecting and going outside of my woes. But the other thing is sometimes they have issues and I'm able to go beyond myself by being present for them. So I find this very, very helpful and effective, having these kinds of empathy buddies. Because otherwise, when somebody's down or they have a really serious situation, no doubt, and I can't do anything, it's just like a drain of energy from both sides. Whereas effective communication really is that effective. So I don't need to give advice. I don't give advice in that state. I just listen. And if at the end I think there's something I might be able to share, I ask permission. I say, would you like to hear what's coming up for me listening to you? But I wouldn't say that unless really there was something coming up. Otherwise, just listening is the best thing we can do for others, in my experience.
Wow. And are these empathy buddies people you know really well or known for many years or worked with?
Not at all. In fact, when we started our practice groups for nonviolence, we would all give our name if we're willing to be an empathy buddy, and anyone could call anyone in the group. So we didn't know each other at all. But what I find is by people being able to speak, you know, as I was saying in the commentary, we all have everything we need within ourselves. So when I just listen to someone, truly listen, it helps them to listen to themselves. So they're able to see deeper kind of needs. And yeah, it's a very interesting process.
Yeah, it sounds it. Okay. The next two questions are similar. The first person's asking, can you please tell us what you mean about being a detached observer in relation to yourself and others with regards to your own mood and theirs? And another person's asking, could you please unpick the practices that you would have used to experience Nyara?
Yeah, I think probably this is why I've been attracted to the nonviolent communication, because I think these two practices of Raja Yoga meditation and nonviolent communication go so well together. Because when that idea of stepping back, it helps me to see the situation as an observer. Whereas what I otherwise tend to do is put a lot of judgment and evaluation into what I'm seeing. You know, and so I might say something like, you always Now, that's already an evaluation. Rather, I could say, when I heard you say that I never wash up, I felt confused because I don't see that it's, you know, I'm needing you to acknowledge what I contribute, and I feel a relationship needs, you know, cooperation, and I need to be cooperative. And so can you also tell me what you've seen that I've done that was cooperative, you know, like something like that. I need to get the conversation really slowed down and unpick it in that sense of really getting to what the person's saying, because, you know, sometimes people do exaggerate even in their own mind, and it's not quite like that, or they assume, or, you know, don't really see two sides. So yeah, it's really stepping back and observing means to see the situation without any evaluation. That's detachment. And it is so hard because we have such a habit of accusing and blaming and exaggerating ourselves and thinking the other person knows what we're talking about. So, oh, you never show me any affection. I mean, what does that mean? So we need to think, what am I needing there? You know, and how can I say that in a way that the other person can understand? You never show me any affection. I mean, what does that mean? What am I wanting? And what's enough? You know, what's never? You know, it's you can see how it's not clear at all.
Thank you. And next question. Can you talk a little more about not fleeing or freezing in front of angry people? My fear definitely takes over at that moment. Are there any tips that keep the fear away or contained so I can respond in an empathetic manner?
Yeah, well, I think that point that I was making, when somebody's shouting, just see it as coughing. They've got an irritant, they've got a discomfort, and it's coming out like that. Just like if someone had something wrong with their throat. So, you know, just see it like that. And if you see it like that, there's more compassion. Because if somebody's distressed like that, I will think, what can I do to ease their pain and discomfort? So that's the first feeling, I would say, for me to emerge. And then to try and listen in amongst what they are saying, to hear what they're needing. And then to ask them. But it does take practice. But to just see that they're not really attacking me. They're trying to get something. They're needing something. And in fact, at least they're communicating with me. You know, worse would be if they don't even talk to me, if they just shut down, because then I can't reach them. At least if they're angry and expressing something, I can try and see what they need. And it's a practice. I'm not saying it's easy. It's not easy, but also staying in my own vibration, you know, knowing that I'm this being and that they also are a being of peace. I'm a being of peace and they're a being of peace. So if I can bring my consciousness to that level, so not seeing an angry person, seeing a peaceful being that's challenged by life's experience and needing help from me, otherwise they wouldn't be shouting at me.
That's a nice way of putting it. they're yelling at me because they're asking me for help. That's a very nice way of putting it. Okay, next question. You talked about not taking things personally. But how do I know when to be humble and honest and take responsibility and not take on other people's stuff?
There's a few different ways this could, it could mean. Like one thing is if someone's seeing my weaknesses, you know, and, you know, they're maybe they're right. I do have those weaknesses. So that's when I often take it personally and become defensive because I'm so embarrassed. I'm feeling often very inadequate. And so I'm, you know, beating myself up often at that time. There was a point where I realized that practically it's going to take me quite a while to change that, those personality traits that are not healthy. So I remember someone pointing something out to me when I was realizing this, and I said, yeah, I know. I am like that. I'm sorry. And I am trying to change, but it's taking me much longer than I thought. And just be assured that I'm working on it. And I would advise you not to keep looking at it because it'll distress you. And I can only change as fast as I can. And I really felt, well, that's the reality. Before that, I used to beat myself up, especially because I was living in a meditation center and I was a teacher. So I used to think, oh, I shouldn't be living here. I'm not good enough. And how can I be teaching others when I'm still like that? You know, and really giving myself such a hard time because of my shortcomings. But I tend not to do that so much. I'm practical. It will take me time, and I just suggest people have to be a bit patient with me, just as I have to be patient with myself.
That's very empowering, actually, to be able to say that. Thank you. Next question. When someone is in a mood, how do I find out their need without being confrontational?
Yeah, I think it's the feeling, like, you know, if someone's shouting at me and I'm really just trying to stay connected and not run away, if I could just ask them, it sounds like, you know, humbly just, it sounds like you're needing ABC. And if you're not, they will tell you, no, I'm not needing that. But at least it's starting to, and then I could ask, well, I'm trying to see what I can do, you know, to help in this situation. You obviously, you know, are asking something of me. So I'm just not clear what you are asking. Because need is not a comfortable word. So even to use that word need often triggers a reaction. But what are you asking of me? What do you, yeah, that's probably the better way to say it. But, you know, it does, first of all, I need to detach. First of all, I need to not take it personally and to go back into, like we just did in the meditation, into my space. Because what they talk about in psychology is getting enmeshed, you know? So when I'm not separate, then I'm getting enmeshed in there, you know, when I react, I'm getting enmeshed in them.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. The last question. The person saying they also are very bubbly and find themselves exhausted after getting really enthused and happy. So the question is, how do I keep my bubbly nature and enjoy it, but still kind of, you talked about stocking peace or happiness. What's the method to do that?
Yeah, so I think when what I did and what I do is when I'm feeling really happy, I let some of it out, but I try to internalize it and just kind of like almost like breathe it in, you know, so that it's kind of nurturing myself. And that's also another interesting point to really nurture myself. I need to know what I need, and I can say, oh, I really thrive on this peace and joy. Oh, I really thrive on it. I'm so appreciative of it. You know, so it's kind of like talking to yourself and not just bubbling it all out, but talking to yourself and recognizing what it's feeding, you know, what it's feeding in me, this particular situation, and savoring it. It's like if you eat something delicious, you know, you can eat it fast because it's so delicious, but then you'll notice you didn't taste it as much as you could have if you'd eaten more slowly and savored it. So it's a bit like that.
Wow. Thank you, Maureen. And that brings us to the end of our event.